That's very true, because Africa has the potential to provide over 40% of the world capacity or potential for solar, but only 1% currently of the generation is from solar in Africa. What this tells you is that we have opportunities. We have an opportunity here to take advantage of this resource and actually make money out of it, because it's not charity. It's a business opportunity that businesses can do and make a lot of money off without necessarily impacting the people.
Omar Al-Maawi, we want to thank you so much for being with us. He's campaign coordinator of the Stop East African Crude Oil Pipeline campaign, known as ECOP, and co-founder of Decolonize. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez will be giving a speech this Friday at Columbia School of Journalism, reflecting on his 40 years of fighting.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
Good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland with you till 9 o'clock here on your community radio station as we gear up for our fall membership drive. Of course, you can perhaps even shorten that by contributing early, going to kboo.fm, click on that old donate electronic button right there. But we'll be talking about that coming up at the end of the month and into December. Right now, well, if you didn't already get clued in by that song, yes, we are talking about the big announcement that was made that we are now 8 billion strong human beings on this planet, this poor, overburdened planet Earth. And I had to play that song. It kind of just came to my mind. That was one of the first albums I bought. That's a Ram by Paul McCartney. It's either his first or his second solo album after the Beatles broke up. 1971 harks back to. I dearly loved that album at the time. Anyway, so it's deep in the fibers of my memory. How exactly relevant it is to the conversation, I will not argue for. But the theme of too many people, of course. So we're going to be talking about that. But as usual, I'll be taking a different take. I'm not going to be, complaining about there being that we have to reduce the population to save the Earth, which in general is true, but it's so much more complicated than that. We all should know that by now. It's the issues of class, race, power dynamics, inequality are front and center. And I don't want to contribute to an oversimplified population debate, but I'm going to have what I think is a very different take on it, which I will kind of leave you with as a teaser. That's what I want to talk about. Of course, there are many things you might want to talk about yourself. The number in 5 minutes or 10 minutes, 503-231-8187 to call in. This is a listener call-in program. This is where you get to share your views with whoever else is listening now and later as a podcast. But first, I have a couple announcements. Medea Benjamin, the co-founder of Code Pink, will be in town tonight in Portland and in Corvallis for two talks tomorrow. And she'll be speaking, and I'm going to talk about her book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. But first, I just want to announce the time and the place. It's at First Unitarian Church, Elliott Chapel. That's at Southwest 12th and Salmon here in Portland from 7 to 9 p.m. Again, that's Medea Benjamin with her brand new book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict, tonight in Portland. Tomorrow, she's going to be speaking at Oregon State University at the Memorial Union. That's on Southwest Jefferson Way. But anyway, you can find all this. I got it going to codepink.org. That's just codepink.org, which has all the tour dates. And then in the evening, she's going to be speaking at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Corvallis. That's tomorrow, 7 to 9 p.m., and that's at Northwest Circle Boulevard in Corvallis. But as I say, you can get that there. And I'm sure you can just Google Medea Benjamin in Portland or Corvallis. You're going to get all that. I just noticed in looking up that Code Pink was actually founded exactly 20 years ago tomorrow. What about that for timing? I don't imagine she planned that, but it's kind of interesting. So I'm just going to read a little bit. This is from Wikipedia. Code Pink was founded on November 17, 2002, by American activists including Jody Evans and Medea Benjamin. The group's name is a play on the United States Department of Homeland Security's color-coded alert system, in which, for example, code orange and code red signified the highest levels of danger. And of course, unless you were born since and not paying any attention, that was not long, just a little over a year after the September 11th event, where a couple airplanes were flown into the World Trade Center towers and another into the Pentagon. Apparently, there's still some differences of opinion about all that. But in February 2003, shortly before the invasion of Iraq, Code Pink organized its first trip to that nation and subsequently led five delegations there. These delegations included parents who had lost their children in Iraq and parents of active soldiers. Additionally, they brought six Iraqi women on a tour of the United States and published a report about how the U.S. occupation affected the status of Iraqi women. On its website, Code Pink lists allegations of U.S. war crimes and states that thousands of civilians were killed in Fallujah in 2004 due to the actions of the U.S. military. Along with other groups, they gave over $600,000 worth of humanitarian aid to refugees of Fallujah in 2004. In 2014, Code Pink was awarded the U.S. Peace Prize by the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation in recognition of inspirational anti-war leadership and creative grassroots action. It describes itself as a grassroots peace and social justice movement working to end U.S.-funded wars and occupations, to challenge militarism globally, and to redirect our resources into healthcare, education, green jobs, and other life-affirming activities. In addition to its focus on anti-war issues, it has taken action on issues such as drone strikes, the Guantanamo Bay detention camp, Palestinian statehood, the Iran nuclear deal, Saudi Arabia, and Women Cross DMZ. It describes itself as female-initiated, has offices, regional offices in Los Angeles, California, and Washington, D.C., and many more chapters in the U.S., as well as several in other countries. I'm not actually sure if they have like an active group in Portland. I don't think I've seen them active as such, but I could be proven wrong. If you're active with Code Pink here in Portland or in Oregon, within the sound of my voice anyway, feel free to call in at some point. Okay, so that's about Code Pink. And there's a lot more about them there. Okay, about the book. As I said, published just yesterday, The War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict. And I'll just read the blurb here as it is. Russia's brutal February 2022 invasion of Ukraine has attracted widespread condemnation across the West. Government and media circles present the conflict as a simple dichotomy between an evil empire and an innocent victim. In this concise, accessible, and highly informative primer, Medea Benjamin and Nicholas Davies insist the picture is more complicated. Yes, Russia's aggression was reckless and ultimately indefensible, but the West's reneging on promises to halt eastward expansion of NATO in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union played a major part in prompting Putin to act. So did the U.S. involvement in the 2014 Ukraine coup and Ukraine's failure to implement the Minsk peace agreements. You've heard all this stuff on this program numerous times. Shouldn't be news to you. The result is a conflict that is increasingly difficult to resolve, one that could conceivably escalate into all-out war between the United States and Russia, the world's two leading nuclear powers. And I will just add, it does look like that wasn't a Russian missile that landed in Poland, but boy, that's the kind of thing, that's exactly the kind of thing that can happen. In a war like that, where you've got NATO right up against Ukraine and Russia, and just things can happen. And that's why people want to have a diplomatic resolution to this, not to mention the vast redeployment of resources that desperately are needed elsewhere, like, for example, the demand by the Global South that reparations be paid by the wealthy, heaviest polluting nations. And those are some of the resources that are desperately used. Anyway, I could go off on that. Let me just read the final paragraph of this blurb on Medea Benjamin's book. Skillfully bringing together the historical record and current analysis, War in Ukraine looks at the events leading up to the conflict, surveys the different parties involved, and weighs the risks of escalation and opportunities for peace. For anyone who wants to get beneath the heavily propagandized media coverage to an understanding of a war with consequences that could prove cataclysmic, reading this timely book will be an urgent necessity. In Portland tonight at the First Unitarian Church on Southwest 12th and Salmon, 7 p.m. In Corvallis twice tomorrow, at noon at the Oregon State University campus, 7 p.m. at the Corvallis Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. God bless those Unitarians. I tell you, they're still opening up their spaces to all sorts of good events. And again, you can get more on that. Go to codepink.org. And I've been reached out to have her on today or last week. It didn't work out because of her touring schedule and travels. And we weren't able to arrange a in-station interview for various difficulties. But I am going to reach out yet again to them and see if maybe we can have her on after she's finished her tour, if that's possible. And actually, it just looks like she's going to be on tour for the next month. But anyway, maybe she'll have a break during our membership drive, and I can have her on, and maybe we can even offer her book as a premium. No promises. I just wanted to get that out and I will announce that again at the end of the program. Oh, another thing, there's this really interesting looking movie that is just coming out also. I think it's making the rounds of the film festivals, and not sure when it's going to be, they're going to have a showings here in Portland. I'm sure they will, but very exciting. On Sacred Ground, the first full-length movie based upon the events of, when was it? 6-7 years ago now? Hard to keep track. The inspiring struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Concourse Media has launched world sales rights during the virtual AFM, whatever that is, on social impact drama thriller On Sacred Ground, starring William Mapother, David Arquette, etc., etc. Directed by Josh and Rebecca Tickell, the film is based on the true 2016 events. Okay, so there, 6 years ago. During the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline that runs through the Standing Rock Indian Reservation, or adjacent to it anyway, in North Dakota on land that is owned by the Lakota Sioux Tribe. I'm not going to read this. There's all sorts of stuff out there, but just the fact that there is this movie out, which is creating a fair amount of talk, and look forward to seeing that. Hope it lives up to its billing. And I just want to read some sad news related. I got this on my an email. I'm on the Indigenous Environmental Network email list. I'll just read as is. Dedicated pipeline fighter and water protector Joy Braun passes away. Eagle Butte, South Dakota. Joy Braun, a citizen of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribal Nation, dedicated water protector, passed away at her home on Sunday, November 13th. She was 53 years old. She was the national pipeline organizer for the Indigenous Environmental Network, IEN, representative to the People versus Fossil Fuels Coalition, and was a proud servant of her people as a grassroots advocate for climate justice. Joy traveled extensively throughout Turtle Island to support Indigenous struggles against extraction and colonization. She was a nonviolent direct action organizer and policy advocate who trained hundreds of people over the years. She was known as a firestorm when compelled to champion calls to action, was fiercely loyal to family, friends, and her community at large. As a founder of the Oseti Sakowin camp at Standing Rock, hers was the first lodge to go up and one of the last to come down, with this beautiful image of this lone teepee there where that amazing scene of army tents and teepees and yurts. Back in the day, Joy was one of the leaders who maintained the grounding tenets of peace and prayer in the months that followed the establishment of this historic and pivotal moment in Indigenous history. So, rest in power, Joy Braun. And now, we will get on to the meat of the program. As I said, if you pay attention to just about any media, I'm sure you must have come across the notice that obviously there's, it's not like there's like one baby that, was the 8 billionth born, and, there's a lot of fuss made over that one baby, but we've known for some time we were approaching that mark, within a few weeks or months or whatever, that has happened, and now we're at 8 billion. That, in itself, 8 billion doesn't mean anything more than, 7 billion or 8.5 billion. So what does it mean to us? So I'm going to talk about, there's the causes and the effects, the impacts of population growth. I'm going to give what I said is, I think, I don't know how much you've heard my take, but I'm going to kind of build up to it. So yeah, the population explosion of humans has been going on, for thousands of years. If you look at a graph, which I'm looking at right now, there's this kind of steady increase, just slow and steady from, say 8,000 BC. It goes up a little bit. And then, after, after, you know, the birth of the Christian era, kind of the age of the big empires, the Roman Empire especially, and even into the Middle Ages, despite the, you know, the Black Plague, there's, you know, dips here and there, but there's kind of a higher increase from, you know, say 1000 BC to 1000 AD, and then it starts going up some more. And then, you know, the mid-1600s, it just skyrockets. It's like a very comparable to a graph. They call it the hockey stick curve, the graph of the emission of fossil fuels and temperature increase. They're very related. So what was going on? Well, obviously the development of agriculture was a big part of it. So, you know, okay, what are the causes? The causes are, you know, increase in births and reduction in deaths. And then, obviously, there's, you know, things, different kinds of food availability. Obviously, you know, settled agricultural peoples, you know, can, you know, with a sort of armies to protect them, can have a greater populations. I'm looking here for some of these basic statistics. You know, increase in longevity has been a big one starting in the 20th century, especially with, you know, modern medicine. Obviously, major changes were like the changes cleanliness, what's the word? Hygiene, especially the containment of human wastes and garbage in general. And, you know, especially, you know, in the 20th century with modern sanitation, you know, the use of water to flush wastes away instead of, you know, they used to just throw them out the window in the, you know, in the Middle Ages and such, except for maybe very wealthy people. I'm just kind of going through a few different sites here. I'm trying to get back to... So yeah, we'll just read this really quickly. So hunter-gatherer lifestyle started to change about 10,000 to 12,000 years ago when humans began to domesticate animals and cultivate certain plants. The agricultural revolution led to profound changes in every aspect of life. Most important, the practice of agriculture greatly stabilized and increased the available food supply. As a result, the human population began to grow faster. About 10,000 years ago, it was estimated there were between 2 million and 20 million people on Earth. By about 2,000 years ago, the population had increased to between 170 million and 330 million. A major change. Human population growth continued through the Middle Ages despite some short-term reversals. The outbreak of bubonic plague in 1347-1352 is thought to have killed about 25% of the population of Europe. But of course, Europe wasn't the only population. In fact, Europe was relatively, quote, underdeveloped as compared to other places like India and China and some other areas that had, quote, advanced civilizations for quite a bit longer. Human population growth began to accelerate after 1650, primarily because of a sharp decline in death rates. Reasons for this decline in death rates included better sanitation and hygiene, control of disease, increased availability of food, and improved economic conditions. While death rates fell, birth rates remained high, resulting in rapid population growth. The human population was about 500 million in 1650 and had risen to about 1 billion by 1800 and 2 billion by 1930, mortality rates fell sharply again in the decades immediately following World War II because of improvements in health and hygiene in the world's poorer countries. Birth rates in these countries remained high, pushing the per capita growth rate to its highest values. It took most of human history for the human population to reach 1 billion, but the population grew from 3 to 5 billion in just the 27 years between 1960 and 1987. Cut to the chase, now we're at 8 billion people. And of course, it's not just so many people, it's the massive amounts of resources that are used. And of course, as we know in the climate debate, the unequal distribution and usage of resources concentrated first in, you know, Europe and the United States, and then expanding to other countries that went through their own industrial revolution. It was obviously the industrial revolution that led to this vastly accelerated, and you know, the deployment of fossil fuels, the discovery, invention of whole new classes of chemicals, of medicines, etc., that led to this vast expansion. I was going somewhere with that, but I'm gonna take a little bit of different take, and I'm gonna just bear with me here. I'm gonna relate it to a series of programs I've been obsessively watching on Netflix over the past, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. It seems like Netflix has a whole lot of programs on cults. And now I have a bunch of these series written down here. I hope I brought that page with me. Good goodness, maybe I didn't. But I think I have it here on my laptop. Most recently, it was a One Touch, which was this well worth seeing. All of these are actually well worth seeing. And you know, it's a discussion in and of itself. I mean, if you've geeked out on some of these programs and want to talk about it, we can talk about that too. But let me try to relate it to this broader discussion, which might be a stretch for you. So okay, One Touch is this woman and her partner who started this group. It was all about female orgasm. And more than that, it was about sort of breaking down taboos, specifically about female orgasm, but in general about human sexuality, you know, our sexuality, like intimacy. And it really, this woman was very charismatic. Apparently she's still, I think, in California now. There's a whole legal case. That's the way a lot of these things end. These programs, they build up how they started, you know, how people got involved, how excited they were, how gradually they realized it. There was some really distorted power dynamics going on, and a lot of financial manipulation, power trips, and then they ended up in, you know, usually the whole thing crashing and burning, and legal travails for the founders, etc. But anyway, this woman seems to have escaped direct legal repercussion. I think there's been a couple people. Anyway, so basically it was a wonderful experience for these people who got involved in it. I mean, and they still speak fondly. That's the other thing, is a lot of the people in these groups still speak fondly about certainly the early days, maybe the middle days, not so much the latter days of these experiences. And because They find this amazing group of, you know, kind of a common purpose, intimacy. A lot of times there's a lot of sex. That's obviously not to be discounted, certainly in that group. It was, you know, essentially it was a sex cult. But early on, these distorted power dynamics weren't so strong or weren't in so much in evidence. And people found this really amazing, tight community of people that had great fun together. You know, I'm thinking of Wild Wild Country, about the Rajneeshis. Oh, here we go. Let's see. Then there was, I think, one called Children of God. There was another one, this yoga master. I forget his name. Just a whole bunch of them, must be at least half a dozen to 10 of these things. And then there's other ones that are somewhat similar, but didn't have the strong aspect of sexuality to them. Okay, so why am I bringing this up? Well, one, because I think, you know, for one thing, we're all looking, you know, or I don't know, we're not all looking for that, but I think this is a bleak culture we live in. It's a over-technologized, overly competitive, you know, alienated from the natural world, alienated from each other, anonymous mass society, you know, difficult to, you know, find friends often, difficult to find good places to hang out that aren't caught up in the capitalist dog-eat-dog world. I think most cable listeners, if not all, would agree that this is not the kind of society we would choose to live in if we had our druthers, as my mom from Kansas would say. So yeah, so it's natural to fall in to these kinds of groups when, again, it's like kind of you're just sort of broken in gradually. You know, some of them have various, there's kind of a you know, there's two techniques that if probably if immediately utilized would turn people off and people wouldn't, but you know, they break people in gradually. But then, you know, there's love bombing, which is just this massive, you know, expression of both emotional intimacy and physical intimacy, massaging, caressing, and then there's the sort of breaking down the ego, which happened in this One Touch movie. It's like basically, you know, trying to destroy the individual ego so that it doesn't challenge the authority of the leaders of the group and their manipulative doing. So, okay, so how does, I'm working up to how this relates. So what I maintain, I guess I'll just say it right off. So what I maintain is that there were internal mechanisms to human culture which inhibited the dynamics that led to population growth. You know, a lot of this is all, there's just too much of an emphasis, I think, on external forces, which again, you know, hygiene and sanitation and food supply. So all that's true, but those, I think those are, again, after effects to the original, what originally led to the breakup, to the development of the kinds of dynamics which led to both imperial culture and the kind of distorted, you know, sociopathic or psychopathic dynamics which exist in these so-called cults, these manipulative groups that people find initially so fulfilling and then turn out not to be so. And so if I've read into, you know, anthropological literature and, you know, kind of done my own thought experiments, I guess. But so in small groups, you know, like groups that have existed over a long period of time that have been able to develop certain mechanisms, there are certain mechanisms for keeping in check the too much individual power by a single person or group of people. And their shaming and shunning are two fundamental ones. There's really sophisticated kinds of social games that are played where, you know, if someone has, you know, is adorns himself in a certain way with something really beautiful, then someone will come along and say, "Oh, that's so beautiful." And there's this sort of thing where then they have to like give that to the person. So the idea of like a person accumulating, like, you know, becoming this, you know, the emperor with all these beautiful clothes, to sort of shift that metaphor, is they're shamed, or, you know, it's basically gamed into giving up some of that. And then there's, you know, the idea that the power is more provisional. It's a sort of situational based rather than institutional. So I don't know. I could go on and give you my, you know, sort of speculative idea of how this all played out. But basically there is an intimacy to these small social groups, which is very, you know, fulfilling to the people, and these very basic mechanisms which tended to prevent the, as I said, the accumulation of power and sort of the development of sort of sociopathic and psychopathic tendencies. You know, and then there was expulsion from the group. You know, and this is when, you know, people could be expelled and then not, you know, they'd be, you know, maybe they could eventually find another human group, but it wouldn't necessarily be easy. Anyway, there's a lot of speculation involved in this, but I will stand by my basic assertion that, you know, the development of large-scale mass society was basically came about because of the breakdown of these small groups. Basically, today we're caught between hyper-individualism, kind of an alienated individualism, like our individual minds are sort of, you know, become connected to a whole host of specific, you know, experiences, cultural experiences, and then we get differentiated, everybody depending on our taste in music, our taste in this, that, and the other thing. And then, of course, there's class differences, which is a whole other dynamic. But the development of we're caught between the hyper individualism and this large scale anonymous mass society. And so, what's the missing middle, as I call it? The missing middle tends to be, you know, the state, the city. It could be your workplace. It could be whatever institution you're involved in. But it's not the kind of organic, intimate social group. You know, there's I call it cultural intimacy or social intimacy. We tend to have lost that. I mean, lucky are the few who have, you know, whether it's a really well-functioning group house, whether it's a real community. You know, there's these eco-villages. I mean, there are these attempts. There's always these attempts. There all have been throughout human history to recreate that sense of small-scale intimacy. And I submit this not just, and that's what's the attraction of these, as I said, these cults that people fall into easily, because, you know, a lot of times we're desperate for that. You know, I could confess my own sense of desperation along these lines, but I'll withhold that right now. So yeah, that's what I'm laying out, is that there's certain checks and balances. You know, if we look at, you know, animal population dynamics, you know, animals they can have these cycles of boom and bust, but they oscillate within certain ranges. I mean, evolution has taken place over a long period of time. And of course, there's what they call punctuated equilibrium, where there's these large scale disruptions of the relatively, you know, a relative equilibrium in ecosystems caused by, you know, usually some external event like a comet, or a big geological event like a large scale volcanic activity, which changes the atmosphere, the gases in the atmosphere, you know, and then there's this long scale, huge time scale of the fluctuations of ice ages and then the interglacial periods, which also have an effect. But anyway, so animals tend to have these inherent, they've evolved these inherent dynamics that limit their population, because it's not in their evolutionary interest to expand out of their niches to the extent that there's a massive die-off. You know, that can happen, but they're usually external forces. So now I'm asserting that humans have both, you know, biologically evolved. For example, you know, that in drought times, apparently, women have conceived fewer babies, that there's certain internal breaks to women's fertility, for example, that have traditionally limited population. And all these things get blown out of the water by the development of mass, you know, settled human civilizations. Okay, and so that's a topic. So what are we all to somehow try to seek these quote cult-like small groups? I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this exactly, but I just think we tend not to look at these under-recognized dynamics, but well, because we're so far from them, we don't live in them anyway. It's hard for us, for example, to, you know, one of the reasons there's such a huge difference between, you know, quote civilized or you know, colonizing peoples and indigenous peoples is because it's a way of life and a mindset that's really hard to get access to because we're so far from it. Okay, I've laid out part of my argument. Oh my God, we've got three lights lined up. I'm not looking at my Facebook page. I apologize if you've been waiting there for a long time. Let's see who we've got. Okay, looks like we've got Norm, first of all. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, Paul.
Hi.
I don't mind you going on and on and on because, you know, you seem to be a pretty smart guy. And I guess part of your job description is to find out stuff that I need to know, being one of those persons that doesn't have the time to, you know, do that kind of stuff. And
or maybe I just think too much. Maybe I have too much time. Anyway, go on. What did you want to contribute to this discussion?
I belong to the recovery community.
Uh-huh.
And that's one of the chosen families that you seem to be talking about.
Yeah, indeed. I hadn't talked about that specifically, but definitely that's a big one. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I got a bunch of brothers and sisters who are like me, and it's comforting. And it makes me feel like I'm not one of those atomized individuals anonymously, you know, walking through, you know, the Babylon. And, you know, don't get a big head. You're not the only awesome talk show host on KBOO. And,
well, I know that.
I'll shut up and, let somebody else talk. Thank you.
Well, no, that's a wonderful contribution. That's a, you know, that's a whole other. I didn't really talk about, you know, well, I started to talk about, you know, group houses, you know, intentional communities, you know, communes. You know, there was a big explosion of communes in the 60s and 70s, but it goes way back in U.S. history. And if you look at history in general, there's actually a really wonderful book called Inversions, which talks about how this dynamic of creating that sort of recreating that small group culture runs through all the way back, that there's these actually guilds or unions, even like in the Roman Empire, where you had people, a lot of people who came from like one area that ended found themselves like in Rome that created this guild, or certain craft guilds, certain, you know, people doing one craft. And they had their own rituals and ceremonies. You know, you've got the Elks, you've got the, you know, the Odd Fellows, you've got these different groups, you know, the Masons. Anyway, okay, enough of me. Let's go to Art, our next person. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi there, Paul.
Hi.
Hi there. You can hear me okay?
Oh, yeah.
I agree with it, the premise of your show today about social networking, or rather... more intimately and living together and sharing, networking, that kind. And I've lived communally all my many settings. So I do like your monologue today. I think you're doing a good job with your monologue, but you know, I say two heads are better than one on a talk show, because then, you know, it's a breaking point where you can, conduct a conversation. You know what I mean?
No, I agree with you. I'll just say, I'll let you go on, but I've been wanting to, I had co-hosts in the past, and I've been looking for other co-hosts. Oh, and good. And also, I think I do better when I have a guest, but anyway, yes, your point is well taken.
Okay, one last thing then. I don't usually get into the social issues myself. I am a bit of a misfit, but I'm not antisocial. Oh geez, lost my train of thought. I just
you don't do.
I wanted to say about the issue of abortion. if it can be included in this conversation or discussion. I say that it's not a man's right to say that women can or can't. It's only a woman's decision, and so that means that the Supreme Court, the male members, shouldn't have been able to rule on the issue of Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, well, good luck with that.
If it were left up to the women, it would have been 3-1 against overruling Roe v. Wade.
Well, then we wouldn't have a patriarchy anymore. I think you've got a fundamental problem there. But yeah,
Work that into the discussion as well, then, and I'll let you go.
Well, no, I think it's very apropos to the discussion of population because, you know, groups throughout history, before this obsess, before the patriarchal obsession with controlling women's bodies, you know, people, that was another way to control the population. It's like if people were living in, you know, this idea that we have this infinity of resources and food availability, we go to the grocery store and we can get whatever we want. It's this, we're living in a fool's paradise. You know, if we lived within the ecosystems, we would live within the ability of the ecosystem provide. And if you're living, you know, closer to the bone, as it were, you're not going to be able to just have all the babies you want. So there were people practiced abortion, people practiced birth control. Anyway, so yeah, so that's it fits right into the conversation. Well, let's go to Nathaniel. Go ahead, you're on the air. Hello? Well, we lost Nathaniel. Well, let's just go right to Marianne.
Hi.
Hi.
So you can hear me okay?
Oh, yeah, you're good.
Okay. Yeah, so I just wanted to say I'm surprised that nobody has brought up making various methods of birth control more available to poor countries, because I don't think that's the real solution to the overpopulation problem. I think the real solution, and the reason, you know, I think we think in this country we're so enlightened we only have 2 children, which actually isn't really true for a lot of the population, but the real reason that we don't have as many children in this country and in Europe and Japan, places like that, is because their children are more of a financial liability now since the Industrial Revolution than they are a financial asset. And the best thing that we could do to limit births in poor developing countries is not to provide them with contraception, which is just a tool. You got to provide people with a motivation. The best thing we could do is make sure that every country has a good, reliable old age pension system like Social Security, so people don't have to worry about having their children support them in their old age.
Well, yeah, I mean, my answer to that, it might sound flippant, is to the answer to a lot of similar propositions, which is that, yeah, well, we need a global socialist revolution so we can actually redistribute the wealth, so we can actually institute sane policies that would actually get us out of the mess we're in. True.
Yeah, right, in general, right. But the other thing I want to say is you've mentioned how animals' population has been limited, and eventually that's going to happen to human beings too. If we don't take care of our overpopulation problem, nature will do it for us.
Yeah, well, our overpopulation, our overconsumption, our overproduction, our over everything. Yes.
Right.
Indeed. And it's a grim prospect. And, you know, I think this is just these thoughts I have late at night and such. I mean, I think there's a psychology at work, which is that I think people kind of know that. And so they got to keep the thing going even more because that's the argument for keeping the whole over thing going, is that's the only way we're going to prevent the kind of collapse that we're talking about. The problem is it just feeds into, it's a vicious cycle. Anyway.
Right, I agree. So thanks. Those are my 2 points I wanted to make.
Well, thank you, Marianne.
Thanks for taking my call. Sure.
All right. Short and sweet. I also like people to expound at further length if they should so desire. I shouldn't be the only one who gets to do that. Anyway, 503-231-8187. I seem to have sparked some interest, which is good. It looks like next up we got Fred. Are you there? Calling Fred. Oh, I think my board op is on the phone with someone else and is not able to bring Fred up, perhaps. Oh, we lost Fred. Well, we got someone else, I think. So whoever you are, go ahead and say your name and talk at us. Who do we got, Ty? Oh, Ty's on the phone. It's hard to be on the phone and bring up the... hear me and bring up the next person all at the same time.
Hello.
Who are you?
I'm not Fred, I'm Brad.
Okay, Brad, go ahead. What do you got to say?
Not much, but you have a couple of things I wanted to interject. One with the last lady about the population is the... without our preconceived and contrived civilization attributes, if you will, we'd be subjected to ecological evolution like all other animals. However, we, due to those constructs I mentioned, we have thanks to women who have the 90% of the mitochondria in their bodies that are the evolutionary spark that does instantaneous mutation, we would have different aspects of that population thing that would be subjected to stress and so forth and so on than animals are naturally. Anyway, my point that I called originally, if you allow me, was to your construct about broadly speaking about cults and so forth and so on. There are different dynamics, as you know, but I think one thing that I didn't quite catch, other than the fact that people are looking for intimacy and closeness and same ideas and so forth to the exclusion of others, there is, let's see if you kind of go along the same ideas, that we're looking for ultimate reasons for these essentials that we're talking about. And I think the thing that's really confounded it, like the monkey ranch, if you will, is and religion displays this as a good example. There's the dominion, which is the patriarchy and all this control and male gender, blah, 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 and religion. And then there's the, sorry, I forget it, benevolence idea or peace or... yeah, contributions to each other according to their needs and so forth. On the other aspect, okay, that's enough.
Okay,
yeah. Get my drift, or
well, the ends of your sentences are sort of falling off. I don't know what's going on, so it wasn't all that easy to catch.
So yeah, that's a good thing.
No, I was trying to understand, but anyway, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly where to go with what you just said.
Okay, well, maybe I'll just let you go, but I'm just trying to interject some ideas that you made me think of.
Okay.
And I was just, maybe my own mind, because I'm not the one seems to understand it, but I thought I was trying to contribute to what you were talking about.
Uh-huh. Well, it's just either the way you talk or the device you're talking into. There was enough that was garbled that I actually wasn't able to get the full sense of what you're saying. I apologize. If you want to try to restate it very briefly.
All right. Okay, I've lost some of my points, like I do many times, but there's enough. Looking for ultimate reasons for the population and that stuff, it's great. I mean, you got to go there as part of what we do. But I thinking of that, I looked for one myself, and that was, I think overall, it's this drive that humanity has had about dominionism and
okay.
In the opposite, the beneficial part of it. That was kind of my point.
Okay. Well, no. Thank you for that. We got to run because we got one more caller and we're almost out of time. I think my point is that dominionism arises from the breakdown of, you know, I'm not saying this is a really complicated issue, and there's people who've devoted way more study to this, and you know. I'm not going to absolutely defend. I'm not really even expressing it as coherently as I might like, but there's expressions of dominance in animals, you know, and we are an animal, so there's going to be expressions of dominance, but it's provisional and temporary. It becomes institutionalized into the kind of dominion, the institutionalized dominance, the imperial expansionist dynamic. That, and I think there is something in other forms of human culture, other than imperial culture, which we live in, which is our natural breaks and inhibitions to that accumulation of institutionalized power. And I think it's found in the kind of small group dynamics that we're all, most of us, are searching for, and is expressed in these unfortunate cult-like groups or whatever that people fall into that I watch obsessively on Netflix. Anyway, so Nathaniel's back. Let's give him his chance to speak.
Hi, Paul. Your system dropped me a long time ago. So, interesting subject, but you went right off the rails right at the beginning of your talk. The hockey stick aspect of population growth is unique. It only happened once. It pretty much started in the 17th century, as you noted. And it's not a matter of just populations grow like Topsy. You know, you've heard of Thomas Malthus, who wrote in the 18th century that human populations tend to grow. They outstrip their food supply, and then they get cut back by plague or famine or war. And there was a burst in the 60s and 70s of that kind of demography. We called it neo-Malthusianism in anthropology. And it's just nonsense. Populations don't grow like that. Human populations don't grow like that. Animal populations don't grow like that, because they're reduced by reduced food supply long before they reach any kind of, you know, topple over phenomenon. Human populations grow because humans need labor. And human population dynamics, human demography is different than animal demography, because we breed other humans. I mean, we call them our children, you know, or whatever, but we go out of our way to form the size of our families. I mean, you talked about using abortion and birth control and all kinds of other things in small-scale societies, in kind of wandering hunter-gatherer societies. Women breastfeed for a long period of time. Breastfeeding suppresses ovulation, so they space their children without even thinking about it, really, just by continuing to breastfeed them. So population started to go off the graph with colonialism. And I actually went to India in 1977 to study population dynamics in relationship to labor supply and land availability and the nature of the food that was being grown. And for various reasons, it didn't work out all that well. The point is that I can just give you one example of India. Populations, even under imperial states in India, pre-colonial states, all the state wanted from people was a share of their production, whether it was food, whether it was labor, whatever. The colonial state wanted something else. It wanted money. It wanted profit. So it took food, it took rice, it took all those labor, it took all those other things, but it also wanted silver. And one of the reasons it wanted silver was because the Chinese didn't want European manufacturers. European manufacturers were crap as far as the Chinese were concerned. They did things better. They did better cabinetry, better pottery, better fabrics, all the rest of it. Europeans wanted them. So India became a source for silver farming to pay for the Chinese manufacturers that the British wanted. And then opium entered into that cycle and became part of the trade dynamics.
Okay,
it radically changed the world.
So what I'm saying is
that the Indian population took off. It boomed because it was dependent on rice agriculture. Rice agriculture turns on labor. You can increase the amount of land is there. It's fixed. It may be the ownership or the use changes around, but the amount of quantity of land is fixed. But the quantity of rice you can get from the land is dependent on how much labor you pour into the land.
I totally agree with you that was the.
So let me finish. Let me finish. Okay. You can scatter your seeds in the field. You know, you can plant the seeds one by one in a nursery, transplant them one by one in the field. So Indian populations took off because of British demand for labor.
Right. It's just we're out of time is all. And I just want to quickly respond. So I don't think what you're saying is at odds with what I was saying. Obviously colonialism, industrialization, et cetera, was why, you know, in the 17th century, this hockey stick, whatever, this exponential curve. What I'm saying, and that was different. That was fundamentally different from previous history. But it was right. Well, it was not fun. It was quantitative or qualitative? It was a qualitative based on certain dynamics. But the stage was set much earlier, is all I'm saying. And I was trying to point to this earlier dynamic of the breakup of the kind of whatever sort of equilibrium mechanisms were at place in India and all around the world that were disrupted by colonialism is part of the same dynamic. Anyway, we could go on and on, but we are totally out of time, and I got to go. Thanks, yep. Nathaniel. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m. Next up is Fight the Empire.